Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Since the beginning of the push for health care reform, politicians like Senator Ted Kaufman of Delaware said the middle class has the most to gain from an overhaul.
Middle class folks, how can you plan your life when you don't know at any time you're going to get your insurance denied because of a pre-existing condition? How can you plan your life if, when you get sick, you're going to lose your health care insurance?
Turns out, he was right. A new report says middle-class Americans are losing their health insurance coverage faster than any other income group. Here I am, stuck in the keeping their jobs but losing their insurance. It's a massive hole in the safety net through which millions of Americans have already fallen. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, March 18th. Not really a surprise that middle-class Americans are losing their health insurance the fastest, right?
The surprise to those in the middle class is how quickly they become poor if they don't have health insurance and get into trouble. The bankruptcies on the rise, all a part of this report. We'll talk later on in the morning. But let's get a check of the morning's top news stories. House Democrats continue to hunt for enough votes to pass that health care reform measure. There are reportedly about 10 votes shy, but there were two votes picked up yesterday. Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich and Republican Representative Dale Kildee of Michigan all are going to vote yes. Congressman Jason Altmaier, a Democrat, voted against the bill the first time around. This time he's undecided, and Democrats and Republicans are giving him the full court press. Altmaier tells ABC News this morning about the kind of attention he's getting.
We're getting phone calls and emails by the tens of thousands on this. There were two planes in Pittsburgh flying over the city yesterday saying, tell Altmaier to vote no on health care.
Congressman Altmaier says he will decide before the weekend which way he's going to vote. A vote's expected on Sunday.
More now on this week's seventh anniversary of the start of the war in Iraq. We're joined by Waria Salehi, president of the Salehi Group, a company that's involved in Iraqi reconstruction. And Waria, you moved back just after the invasion in 2003. You had high hopes then. Do you feel those hopes have been fulfilled?
Not 100%. I would not say so. I would expect more to happen, but indeed not.
In 7 years, it's been a little bit slow. How has the country changed since that day?
Well, there's a lot of positive changes. I don't want to be negative all about it. I'll just give you one example. For example, open media and access to information, what's happening in the world and within Iraq. This was available 2003 and prior to 2003. Now everybody can open their TVs or check their emails or internet, and they could find all information on access, and they have access to all kinds of information. So this is, I think, it's a positive step.
Okay, we're going to ask you about some of those other changes in just a moment. Waria Salehi, stay with us.
It's hard to imagine, really. 7 years ago, that war began this week. U.S. official says a missile strike last week killed an al-Qaeda leader linked to the December suicide bombing of a CIA post in Afghanistan. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Moscow this morning, hoping to wrap up a nuclear arms treaty, among other issues.
And more than a million high chairs are being recalled this morning because they pose a hazard to children. The recall involves high chairs made by Graco Children's Products. Also, Kraft Foods is cutting the salt content of the product that it sells in North America by 10%. That'll make Michelle Obama happy. More than 1,000 products will be affected. Let's check in now on the markets. Asian markets are down. European indices are up, though. Futures remain flat. The Dow is now at its highest point for the past 18 months. It gets underway at 10,733. The S&P opens at 1,166 and the NASDAQ at 2389.
In about a half hour, we'll get first-time claims for unemployment, the weekly number. And coming up, the American middle class is losing its health coverage because of job losses and other things faster than the rich or the poor. We mentioned it at the top of the hour. Later on this hour, we're going to talk about the economics, but what does it mean to you? Would you skip a dental checkup but shell out for minor surgery? Opt for generic drugs so you can afford the yearly checkup? If you're in the middle class and have to deal with these cost issues, how do you set the priorities? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at our site, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Iraqis, remember the war beginning 7 years ago.
It's It's almost 7 years since the United States-led invasion of Iraq began, and the country is now awaiting the results of the March 7th parliamentary election. We felt it was a good time to check in with Iraqis on the state of their country and how far it's come in the past 7 years. We're joined again by Waria Salehi. He's with us from Kirkuk. He's president of the Salehi Group, a company involved in reconstruction in Iraq. And also Lubna Naji joins us from Baghdad this morning, a 24-year-old medical student at Baghdad Medical School. Lubna, you were a teenager 7 years ago when the invasion began. I'm wondering if you could kind of compare that day before, the feeling in Iraq before the invasion, and what it's like now.
Well, look, you know, at the beginning of, you know, the invasion, you know, we had, you know, as young people, we had such great hopes for the future of our country. We thought that Iraq is going to be like a prosperous, you know, peaceful nation, powerful nation, and that we are going to get rid from one of the most evil dictators on the face of earth, who's Saddam Hussein, as you know. But the problem is that, you know, there has been lots of disappointments, you know, over the way. But I can tell you that the mood at the moment is much better than it used to be before in 2006 and 2007. There is much hope. There is much faith in the future. But there is still a lot to be done and a lot of unsolved problems that's going to make such, you know. So it's kind of difficult to compare, if you ask me to compare the period under Saddam Hussein to the time period under the invasion. But I can tell you that, you know, if there's one thing that I would miss about the time period of Saddam Hussein, it's the element of, you know, stability and predictability. Life used to be very bad under Saddam Hussein, but at least, you know, life used to be stable, you know, things used to be predictable. But after the invasion, life, you know, has become bad as well. But the problem is that there is the element of surprise. And, you know, most of the time, those surprises weren't good. You know, you would hear that a loved one of yours, you know, has been either killed or, you know, injured or, you know, had received threats or whatever. So the element, we lost the element of stability and predictability. That's the problem that we used to suffer from. But I can tell you that things at the moment are a little bit better than they used to be before. But as I said, there's still a lot that must be done. Yes.
Okay, Waria Salehi, you actually, things are bad enough in Iraq that you left the country and came to the United States and returned after the invasion. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And you started a nonprofit which does microfinancing projects for business people in Iraq now.
Yeah, actually for poor people who have no access to conventional funds or the banks.
So with your clients that come in to get financing for their businesses, what kind of sense do you get from them? Do you get the sense from, as you heard from Lubna, that there's less stability but a better country now?
Well, yes. To be fair, there is less stability, but it's better country. And people like us, we believe that the country has a chance to become a good country down the road, when at the time, prior to 2003, there was no such a feeling or chance for Iraq ever transformed to an open society, open market, and open media, and so on. So we have a chance. But also, to be fair, in past 7 years, a lot of more progress should have been done, which has not been done, in my view. The government could be more transparent and more institutional rather than a lot of corruption and so on.
So you were in the United States for a while, and you've had a chance to see the elections as they work here and the election as it worked in Iraq recently. Do you feel like there's a burgeoning, fair democracy there in Iraq, your own version there in your country?
I think this one was much better if you compare them and use them as a measurement to the last one. This one was much fairer than the past one. However, this is there's no way to compare the Iraqi elections, which was happened 2 weeks ago, to U.S. elections, because still there's a lot of mismanagement, no systems in place, and to some extent there is a corruption and playing with ballots and playing with people's votes. But I think if I personally compare to the last one, I think there's a bit of progress, and we are going toward hopefully open and fair elections.
Okay, that's Waria Salehi. He is the president of the Salehi Group that's working on microfinancing projects for low-income people in Iraq. And we also spoke with Lubna Naji, a 24-year-old medical student at Baghdad Medical School. Let's turn now to Adele Darwish, a British author and journalist. Adele, we just heard some kind of frustrated optimism from two people who are living in Iraq. Is that kind of typical coming out of these elections?
Yes, it's actually a typical comment. I mean, as for Lubna, she's a very bright, actually, student. She corresponded with everyone on Facebook. And obviously, she was too young to remember the bad days of Saddam. But something interesting, the predictability element and the stability under Saddam, life was predictable. It was bad, but predictable. They can calculate what happened every day. But in the general, larger picture, Iraq now is a democracy. There's only two nations in the Middle East who actually can claim they have a Western-style democracy where they can change the government through the ballot box, not through a military coup or interference of biology that the ruler would die after ruling 50 years. It's Israel and Iraq. And the improvement here, that there's maturity in the way the Iraqi are voting. But there's another type of frustration, the inability of the two larger groups, the one led by incumbent Prime Minister Nour el-Maliki and his opponent Ayad Alawi, who is a much better and more seasoned politician, there's be a inability of either of them to have a decisive coalition government that can implement policy. The problem with coalition government is stagnation and policy is difficult to implement.
Okay, so you also sound like you have some sort of frustrated optimism.
For instance, optimism, they are moving to democracy. Once they repair the electoral system, make a constituency system instead of proportional representation, I think it would be much, much, much better and would be perhaps the best democratically ruled country in the Middle East.
Okay, Adele Darwish, British author and journalist. He joined us from London. Thanks so much. Now let's check in on the top stories at 15 minutes past the hour.
President Obama has stepped up his efforts to gain support for the health care reform legislation. He gave a confident interview to Fox News, and the president's health plan received a boost from liberal Congressman Dennis Kucinich.
I've decided to cast a vote in favor of the legislation.
Today, the Congressional Budget Office is expected to release its cost analysis of the bill, and the White House hopes that will turn votes as well. Overseas, drone strikes in Pakistan's border region have driven al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders deeper into hiding. CIA Director Leon Panetta tells The Washington Post the attacks, quote, have them on the run.
It was a joyful reunion in Haiti. All but one of the 33 children who were given to American missionaries 6 weeks ago have been returned to their families. And there's tight security on the campus of Virginia Tech this morning after mysterious emails and internet postings threatened another attack on campus. Police say they don't think the threats are credible. In 2007, a student shot and killed 32 people on the campus of Virginia Tech. And finally, rock musician Alex Chilton of the Box Tops has died of apparent heart problems at the age of 59.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train.
That's Chilton singing one of the great rock songs, The Letter, a song he made popular when he was just a teenager,
actually.
Sounds
like a 59-year-old with that gravel.
Yeah, later he was a member of the band Big Star, and he helped lay the foundation for indie rock. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, how much do you make every year?
We went from $130,000 a year to $60,000.
Salary is one of those things people have trouble talking about. We're going to talk about some of the other things that are hard to talk about in a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
To go, yes. because it's a Capitol Hill Good News takeout that begins this segment. Todd Zwillick joins us, Takeaway Washington correspondent. The Senate has cleared an $18 billion jobs bill. There's bipartisan support. The president is expected to sign it, but $18 billion, Todd, feels like a drop in the bucket to me. I don't know.
Yeah, for the size of the unemployment problem that we have, you know, kind of is. Not to mention the fact that John, this Senate bill did pass. It is ready to go to the president. They're calling it a jobs bill, and it is that. But you know, they have some tax credits for new hiring. If you hire somebody who was previously unemployed, they have some money for highway funds to spur highway projects. Some payroll tax relief, which is all a positive. There's a question though about how much new job creation this leads to, because it doesn't do anything to stoke demand. You know, it's one
unless let's look at the one piece. Yeah. I mean, the centerpiece is the whole thing about saying to employers, we'll give you a break from your Social Security taxes. That's the FICA thing, right?
Right?
We'll give
right.
you a break from that if you can show that you hired people, right?
Right.
How many people
yeah.
are going to do that? We have no idea, right?
Right. We have no idea. And a lot of employers sort of, you know, you're reading out in the press and hearing from a couple people on the Hill and senators who weren't terribly thrilled with this bill, saying, yeah, it's one thing to give the tax break, but you know, if you make, you know, your doorknob making business, if there's not any new demand for doorknob, if there's not
right.
any new clamoring for doorknobs, the tax break doesn't do a whole lot. Thanks for the tax break, but why would I hire if I'm not selling any more doorknobs?
In a recession where demand is depressed, you need direct job support more than these kinds of incentives. That's the economic argument there, right?
Yeah, it absolutely is, and you need something to stoke demand. You know, highway projects may do that because once the building starts, you got to hire to do the building. The other stuff, a little questionable about actual job creation.
What's the political fallout from this? I mean, it seems to me, you know, a year ago, trillions of dollars, you know, tens of billions of dollars going to the banks, but only $18 billion for jobs. Does that come back to haunt lawmakers, Republican or Democrat?
I don't think so, because the demand now from the public, or at least as it's perceived on Capitol Hill, is for less spending, not more, John. But also on the job creation front, this is supposed to be only one in a whole series of jobs packages. Democrats are promising there will be many, many job creation efforts in succession. They feel like they can't do anything really big all at once right now because
cost containment is the issue.
Cost containment,
right?
And that's hue and cry from too much spending.
And that's the whole issue with the Congressional Budget Office. I mean, going over to healthcare reform for a moment, the Congressional Budget Office is going to issue its report on how much the healthcare reform bill in the House is going to cost, and that's critical to the passage. What kind of a number are they looking for?
Well, people are dying for that number right now. They're supposed to get it last night, and it didn't come out. And when I say dying for the number, it's because there's a new scheduling crunch. When that number comes out, there will be a starting gun of 72 hours. Right now, the healthcare bill will be voted Sunday at the earliest. We don't know exactly how big, but Democrats need to have that number under $1 trillion. In fact, they'd like it closer to $900 billion, of course, all paid for over 10 years, they say. And it's not just the number. It's also the policy that we're going to see. You know, who gets more help under this bill? What happens to the Medicare donut hole for grandma and grandpa's prescription drug costs? You know, all that stuff will be in there when we finally get it. Then they can start the clock to have a vote. Well, we're working Sunday, I'm sorry to say, but that's the way it is.
And Dennis Kucinich of the dark hair and leftist outlook is voting for this. He changed his vote. Is he low-hanging fruit or sign of a trend?
I think the former. There didn't seem to be a whole lot of feeling in the Democratic caucus that Kucinich's decision to flip from no to yes sent a lot of shockwaves or even ripples
right.
through the Democratic caucus. They have still a lot of heavy lifting with moderates and conservatives. He was low-hanging fruit.
All right. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, watching health care reform and everything else on Capitol Hill.
And now to our listeners for the next takeout. The big banks got a bailout from the government, and we're giving you a tips on how to bail out yourself, part of our 10-part series, DIY Bailout with contributor Beth Kobliner. But like the first step in any 10-step program, we focus on how to admit you have a problem.
But
why is it
steps.
So hard? Well, we're only doing 10.
Well, in a recession, it's 10
yeah,
steps.
We've yeah. condensed.
Right, there we go.
So why is it so hard to talk about money?
I'm calling from Jones Island, South Carolina. My name's Annie. I lost my job at the end of December 2009, and my husband took a pay cut at the same time. We worked for the same firm. We went from $130,000 a year to $60,000 a year. It's been a good challenge, but we're up for it.
That is a huge change. Candor. Laura Candor. In Colorado posts to our site, thetakeaway.org, we are deeply in debt, and since my husband has a hands-off approach to our finances, I feel I'm responsible for it all. I always feel like the bad guy when I tell anyone in the household that we cannot buy something or go somewhere.
Ricardo from Oklahoma City tells us why he thinks finances are a taboo topic. He says, could it be because we measure success based on financial wealth? If we don't have enough, we're not considered successful. If we make too much, we let people know, just not exactly how much.
You can take part, share your story, be part of our series DIY Bailout on our website, thetakeaway.org. Next Wednesday, we'll have part two for you. How do you set a list of priorities when you're trying to get yourself out of debt? You have a success story or anything else, share it with us at thetakeaway.org or call 877-8-MY-TAKE.
What do you pay first? What do you let wait?
Right.
We have strategies for you, and we want to hear yours. Also on our site, you can catch up on all of our census coverage. Later this morning, we're going to talk about how the government defines race and how
the possibility of the person being able to decide is something new.
That's right. It used to be the census determined what race you were. That's Nell Irvin Painter, author of The History of White People. We'll hear more from her later this morning. And if you've got a census story, tell us.
Hi, this is Derek from Oklahoma City. And when my wife opened up the census in the mailer, she sat down, started filling it out, and singing the national anthem. And then asked me if she was weird. So, I don't know. You tell me.
She's fabulous. We love her. Derek, thanks for calling. We'll have our listeners do that for us. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But when you fill out your census form, what are you thinking? Why are they asking me this? Give us your census critique, if you like, at 877-8-MY-TAKE and see other stories at thetakeaway.org. Good morning, everyone. Coming up, middle-class Americans are losing their health insurance coverage faster than the rich or the poor. You're keeping score and you know who you are. If you lose coverage, are you still middle class? We'll talk about that in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. A lot of politicking today as the expected health care vote approaches this weekend in the House. The Congressional Budget Office is likely to release its analysis of the bill today. House Democrats are reportedly about 10 votes shy, even after picking up two votes yesterday. Pennsylvania Congressman Jason Altmaier voted against the bill first time around, claims he's undecided, tells ABC News this morning he's getting a lot of attention.
It's been unbelievable. We're getting phone calls and emails by the tens of thousands on this from all around the country. There were two planes in Pittsburgh flying over the city yesterday saying, tell Altmaier to vote no on health care.
Altmaier says he will decide which way he's going to vote, the Democratic congressman will, before the weekend.
More and more people are doing their taxes themselves in order to save money, we're told. USA Today is reporting that companies like H&R Block are seeing double-digit declines in traffic from this time last year. And, you know, there's something both men and women say that a foreign accent can be very sexy. But which is the sexiest?
What's foreign?
A research company asked 5,000 women. Their top five were in order: Australian, Irish, Italian, French, and Scottish. But wait a second. One of our listeners, Hector, says you've got one missing.
I feel a little left out. How about Cubans? We have a sexy accent. Oye, mami, ¿qué pasa? ¿Qué hola? You got to keep us in the loop.
I'm totally with you, Hector. Cuban is a dead sexy accent. Let us know yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Quick check on the markets. Futures are up. The Dow starts at 10,733. The NASDAQ opens at 2389. And the S&P, 1166. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Every day we're looking for consensus on U.S. healthcare, and the industry's costs are out of control. We can all agree on that. Coverage is also available for only certain segments of society. We can agree on that. The rich are okay. The very poor have a Medicaid safety net. The elderly have Medicare. Needy children have state-administered S-CHIP programs. The middle class, though, they basically have what's jangling around in their pockets. And if you can't afford retail health insurance and you know who you are, you're on your own. Which makes it perhaps less surprising that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation finds that middle-class Americans are losing their health insurance coverage faster than any other income group. Brian Quinn joins us now. He's a senior program officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Good morning, Brian.
Hi, John. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about some of the broad kind of big picture statistics in this report, but also with us is Dr. Leland Chow, who's a chief medical officer at People's Community Health Centers in Baltimore. Good morning, Dr. Chow.
Good morning.
One thing, if you could give me a sense of a person that you've encountered in your practice or in your work who's been faced with precisely the economic conditions that I've described, that costs are rising, they're unable to afford coverage, and they realize suddenly that there's really nothing out for them as a, out there for them as a safety net.
Absolutely. Just last week, I had a new patient who had a wonderful job prior to her becoming unemployed, and she needed to have ongoing care for chronic medical conditions. So she came to our health center and was just really grateful. But she's one of many who the face of our patients are definitely changing. It's less minority. It's definitely a different socioeconomic class. We saw 13,000 unduplicated patients last year in our network of health centers in Baltimore.
What does unduplicated patients mean?
Oh, it means that we saw them once over the past year, and 50% of them actually were uninsured, and that's definitely a greater percentage than we're accustomed.
And
15,000 showing 53,000 visits.
And these are first-timers, which means they're just entering this category, right?
Some of them are established patients, but we saw many, many new patients last year, and most of them are uninsured.
What's the sense of humiliation or change or alarm in the face of a patient like that who suddenly goes from a fabulous job and security to relying on clinics such as yourself?
Well, our mission has always been that we serve all. That's healthcare for all has always been our motto. We've been around for 40 years. However, there is a change in their primary care practice, and it's different for them. And it's something new. So when I saw this patient last week, she just broke down in tears because
wow.
She just didn't expect to have such wonderful care, actually, in a practice that she did not anticipate providing such. So it was pretty emotionally charged for her.
Dr. Leland Chow describing the story of someone who presumably middle class discovering that they're no longer covered and without any sort of a safety net in the healthcare industry right now. Brian Quinn, you don't measure tears in the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation study, but there's nothing unusual about that story, is there?
Not at all. In fact, in Maryland, we found that the percent of middle-class Maryland residents with employer-sponsored coverage fell over the last decade from about 75% to 62%. And we know that, as you mentioned earlier, public insurance programs like Medicaid are not covering these middle-class populations. And so that we see big jumps in the uninsured in this population.
And so the COBRA program, which is supposed to keep people insured for some period of time after they lose their job, is really not adequate to keep people from falling off the cliff here. Is that what your study shows?
That's right. I think our study covered data through 2008, which is the most recent data you can get from the Census Bureau. And so that was before the really big downturn in the economy. It's possible that the situation could be quite a bit worse here in 2009 and 2010.
So these are COBRA programs ending, people losing their job. That's one sort of driver that's pushing this population up. But the other one, and you describe it in the report, is the actual cost of healthcare options if you have to go retail. What's that like?
That's quite right. We know there are many horror stories about people trying to buy coverage in the individual market. If you live in a state with good insurance regulations, laws that limit things like pre-existing conditions and denial of coverage and benefits, oftentimes that coverage is prohibitively expensive. In states that are unregulated, individual insurance plans can make it very difficult for people to get coverage by keeping people out who have these pre-existing conditions.
Wow. Brian Quinn, Senior Program Officer of Research and Evaluation at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Dr. Leland Chow, you're an MD. What's your specialty?
I'm a family physician.
Family physician. How much of your time do you have to spend advising people on insurance strategies as well as healthcare strategies?
Oh, that's an excellent question. It seems that more and more these days I'm spending several minutes of my valuable time that I have with my patients just talking about, you know, their insurance and their financial worries that they greatly impact their health. So just trying to navigate the healthcare system. Now, our sliding fee program through the federal government is fairly straightforward. We just need their documentation of inability to pay, but it certainly wears on their minds.
All right, Dr. Leland Chow, Chief Medical Officer at People's Community Health Centers in Baltimore. Thanks so much for being with us. Final question for you, Brian Quinn. If you don't have health insurance in this economy in the United States, can you even say you're middle class anymore?
That's a great question, John. We've historically thought about this being a problem that really affects low-income populations. It's clearly moving up the income ladder and starting to hit a big chunk of Americans.
Well, for the middle class, navigating the healthcare domain is very, very much other than smooth sailing. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has a report that the middle class is losing their coverage faster than anyone else. Brian Quinn, Senior Program Officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, helped author that report. Thanks so much for that. We'll turn the conversation over to listeners. As it costs more to get treatment, we're thinking trade-offs. What's one health expense you'd skip if you were faced with the dilemma our guests were talking about there, and one that's unavoidable? Monica posts to us on our Facebook site, total coverage when you are not working is a huge expense. I would risk not having insurance to pay insurance co-payments and prescriptions. What would you do? 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to our site, thetakeaway.org. Tech talk about batteries coming up.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. How many times has this sound awoken you early in the morning on a Saturday or Sunday and left you cursing the owner of the car? Now imagine that happening all over town. Dozens of vehicles. That's what happened in Austin, Texas late last month before police arrested the person responsible, who was 20-year-old Omar Ramos Lopez. He was arrested yesterday and slapped with computer intrusion charges. Turns out he was using his home computer to set off alarms all over the city, and that's not all he was doing.
Whacking the cars with the computer.
No.
He was using the...
Yeah, he was sitting at home causing the alarms to go off, and that's not all he was doing.
Freaky.
John Abel has been reporting on this story for Wired.com. John, welcome back.
Good morning.
So he went further than setting off alarms from his computer. What else did he do?
Well, the purpose of this sort of technology is to disable the car. This is put on cars that people with a very dodgy credit agree to have in order to get the car. And the point is, if you don't make your payment, you can't start your car. So that's what you can do with this stuff.
So he sat at his computer in his regular old web browser, and because he had the password, he was able to not just set off car alarms, but immobilize these cars. The owners couldn't start them.
That's correct. Using the technology for exactly what the technology is meant to do, although he wasn't authorized to do that anymore and was using someone else's account. That's
why right. did he do this?
He was the proverbial disgruntled former employee, and he managed to convince a soon-to-be former disgruntled employee to give him his credentials. His account had been canceled, but he just thought he'd get a little payback to the company that fired him.
Okay, please tell me, John Abel, if I'm justified in being a little bit worried about this whole thing. I also hear commercials from OnStar that says they can remotely unlock my car, and it makes me nervous that somebody from some computer screen in some other state even could be messing with my vehicle.
Well, if you have dodgy credit and you don't make your payment, you have every reason to be worried. But both these kinds of things and the OnStar thing are sort of opt-in. They are opt-in.
Right.
And OnStar is actually a peace of mind sort of comfort service, because it's used to do things like open your car if you can authenticate that
you're locked out
over the phone, right? And to slow your car down if it's been stolen, so you have a slow speed chase on the highway. Rather than never seeing your car again. And, of course, OnStar is the company that says we can find your car, we can locate your car if it's stolen. So same technology, same idea, totally different demographics.
There's nothing to be worried about in this technology that lets people remotely mess with my vehicle.
It's people that mess with technology, not technology with people.
Oh, my God. I don't know about that, pal. That's scaring me.
Well, it's not in your car unless you agree to have it there.
Right. That's true. Yeah. But the future will be we won't know it, right?
I doubt very much that the car industry, which is already desperate to get your business, will do anything to sabotage that.
Good point.
Okay,
good point.
John Abel is the New York Bureau Chief for Wired.com. He's talking about this case in Austin, Texas, where a disgruntled employee, basically that's what he did. He was ticked off that he got let go.
And he remotely...
He remotely, not just set the car alarms, but imagine walking outside to go to work... and, you know, your car doesn't start. And it's some guy sitting, you know, in his
Poltergeist.
T-shirt.
I saw that movie.
It wasn't a poster guard. It was Omar Ramos Lopez messing on his web browser. It's a weird story out of Austin.
John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, our next guest suggests for 3,000 years. That's how long everyone on planet Earth has been looking for the perfect battery, the holy grail of tech, in our tech segment in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories. At coming up to 48 minutes after the hour, Wall Street traders apparently enthusiastic about some economic news that's just out this morning. Futures are solidly positive now. Jobless claims dropped slightly last week to 457,000, and consumer prices were flat last month as a weak economy limits a company's ability to charge more for goods and services. Inflation still in check. President Obama will sign a jobs bill today, one day after it cleared Congress. Some estimates the bill will create 250,000 jobs. And Democrats looking for a vote on health care reform say they've gained two votes. Congressman Dale Kildee of Michigan and Dennis Kucinich say they're now yes votes.
Now to a new report on the business of torture. A committee in the European Parliament says several European countries are allowing companies to export tools and devices to be used specifically for torture. From the BBC in London, our takeaway producer Kent DePinto joins us now. Kent, what countries are named in this report, and what are the products that there are being exported?
Well, Celeste, the important thing to remember is that what is potentially illegal here is that these countries are signing off on export licensing. So the EU said that the countries that are named in this report essentially are Germany, Italy, the Czech Republic, countries that have signed have agreed to a law that bans the licensing of exports for these weapons. And these countries have been continuing to sign off on these exporting licenses, allowing things like thumb screws, electro body cuffs that are electro sleeve cuffs that are allowed to that shock you up to 50,000 volts, something called body hangers, which are used in conjunction with foot warmers, which sound very gruesome. The report is alleging that they are exporting them to countries with known human rights violations.
So basically, they've signed this European Union agreement saying we will not allow companies to export these devices, and then they go ahead and okay licenses to companies that export them. Do the countries have any defense?
Exactly. Well, the defense is that this legislation clearly isn't working. I mean, this was introduced in 2006, and, you know, the EU has very strong regulations against torture, and it's one of the only, group of countries in the world or political body that explicitly tries to outlaw it. So, yes.
Okay. Takeaway producer Kent DePinto from our partner, the BBC in London. Finally, Education Secretary Arnie Duncan wants to link college basketball graduation rates with postseason play.
It's about time.
He says, why just basketball? That's my question. He says colleges that don't graduate at least 40% of their basketball players should be banned from any postseason tournaments. 40% seems low to me.
Yeah. I think so. There's only one. There's one team in the tournament that has 100% graduation rate.
Who?
Utah State.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So, something new. I
read it in my blog
you,
post. Read it in my blog post.
Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
Last year, the action, returning the reaction. We got ripped and torn away. Hypnotizing power, crushing all the cower. Battery is here to stay.
It's Thursday here on The Takeaway. That means we talk about technology. Batteries are here to stay. Of course they are. The humble battery. It's kind of the holy grail of tech. And we're going to pay tribute to it with our next guest, Henry Schlesinger, author of a new book called The Battery, How Portable Power Sparked a Technological Revolution. He's here with us in the studio to explain all sorts of secrets we may not know about the little power source that could, sometimes couldn't. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning.
You know, this is a great story, the search for a battery, something that delivers electricity on demand and you can kind of carry it around with you, goes way back, and it is a holy grail. It's not an exaggeration.
It is. The battery continues to improve, and it continues to try to catch up to technology. Batteries tend to lag a little behind the technology.
And they are a real limiting technology for all the kinds of things that we hope we're going to develop in the future. You know, wind power, photovoltaics all depend on batteries. Electric cars depend on batteries. And, of course, the digital revolution has depended on small, portable lithium-ion batteries.
Sure. But the good news is that there's many different types of batteries now, a lot of different types of chemistries, and more on the horizon, and different formats of batteries.
You know, you go back to the very, very early days of batteries, and I'm wondering if there's a pattern. We know the kinds of people who are in software development, for instance, or in aerospace, the kinds of scientists that are attracted into those fields. The battery folks, they're an unusual bunch, wouldn't you say?
They are. Going back, you know, they were mostly amateur scientists
right. And
professors. Alexander Volta was a professor and a physics professor instruments maker. Luigi Galvini was a doctor, an anatomist in Bologna. And then we have a lot of people just fooling around with different acid bases and different metals.
Thomas Edison was one of them.
Thomas Edison was one of them. He spent about 10 years trying to develop a battery for cars.
And didn't work out.
By the time he got something that was usable, the Model T had already taken off and become dominant for cars. He thought, and he always thought, that the gasoline, the internal combustion engine, was just an interim technology. He didn't realize how long that interim would be.
That's interesting. And again, so many people have bet on batteries and lost. As many have bet and lost as have bet and won.
That's true.
Describe to me the chemistry of batteries without getting too technical here, and we don't want people to run to their cars and drive immediately to work because we're going to talk about chemistry here. There are certain chemical configurations that produce certain voltages
right. And
others that produce other voltages. There's a chemical reason why all carbon batteries have 1.5 volts, right?
Right. Well, the big thing, I think, the big misconception is that batteries store electricity the way a glass stores water. The truth of the matter is batteries are little power plants that produce electricity through oxidation, essentially rust, setting the electrons free.
It's basically how many electrons can be dumped off of these atoms, and you put these
right. Chemicals
together that actually are a little bit unstable,
right. And
you hold them in a kind of a equilibrium and let the electrons come out in a nice, reasonable form.
Right.
But some batteries catch on fire, like, of course, the laptop batteries a few years ago.
Well, that was a design flaw or production flaw in the, the idea is to get as much surface area as possible, to pack as much material as possible, and it was just packed a little bit too tight there.
For the laptops.
For the laptops.
Now, in the future, you describe at the end of this book that battery design is going to really change from a centralized, huge block, huge brick kind of power system to something that's distributed, maybe almost biological in its nature. Describe how batteries might be decentralized as power sources.
Well, we live in a portable world. Things are becoming increasingly more portable, so you're going to see a lot of different configurations. For instance, you'll see supercapacitors, which actually do hold an electric charge like most people think batteries do today.
Where will they be deployed?
Those might be anywhere from, small devices to larger devices. But the advantage to them, to the supercapacitors, is that they charge very quickly. You'll be able to charge your cell phone in 3 or 4 seconds.
3 or 4 seconds?
Yeah.
And these batteries are also getting to be the size of cells to be distributed like throughout the body or throughout a device.
Right. Those are nano things. Those will probably be charged wirelessly.
And what's the most surprising sort of story you determined from your exploration of the battery world?
The most surprising story was probably just how they crept along and kept going and kept going into different formats.
And do you have a favorite battery? AAA, D, C?
Probably the flat
pretty
film.
Fond of
flat film batteries.
Flat film batteries.
They're almost as thin as paper, so you'll be able to use them with electronic paper in the future.
All right. Henry Schlesinger chronicles the development of all kinds of battery designs in his book, The Battery, How Portable Power Sparked a Technological Revolution, which really means we should go out on Metallica, don't you think?
Absolutely.
One of your favorite songs, I can imagine.
It's in the book.
You can hear that conversation a second time or anything else that airs on our show at the site, thetakeaway.org.
Pretty typical Metallica fan, didn't you think, Henry, there?
No. One thing you definitely want to listen back to is this new report that says that the middle class is losing their health care coverage faster than the rich or the poor. And it got us thinking about, as health care costs more and more, you probably make trade-offs. So what's one health expense you'd skip and one that you absolutely have to pay for?
Good morning. Troy from North Dakota calling. I employ a classic middle-class healthcare priority system, one that my parents taught me by example. That is, prioritize your kids and neglect yourself.
Ah, I know that well. What about you? Would you skip a dental checkup but pay for minor surgery? Let us know at 877-8MYTAKE or at our website, thetakeaway.org. That's also where we have this very lively competition going on slogans in our new T-shirt contest. We're making new T-shirts. We're looking for your six-word slogans, and we've got entries like Enough is Enough, End Stupidity,
that's
or
good.
Build a Bridge, Get Over It, and I'd Rather Be Sleeping. You can let us know yours at thetakeaway.org.
Well, there's an obvious one, though.
What's that?
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Great shirts.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.